Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward. Today's articles are from the November 2024 issue. I'll begin with a story titled Discourse to Self by Rosalind Brown. Try. Start here. Try bringing a pot of coffee out into the sun in despite of the hot weather, and sit at your chair and table ready for all possible assimilations. Include with this coffee something slightly intensely sweet. Not slightly sweet, but slightly intensely, since all intensities only need to be slight at this point. Sit and drink the coffee and eat the chocolate. And here's the thing. Stop making the mistake of trying to show other people that furthermost corner of yourself. It is good for one thing only. Walk calmly over and ask them for it back. Remember, for instance, that telling people you are reading Tolkien late at night fatally alters the chemical composition of doing this. Also, stop celebrating, or qualifying that a little. Remember that celebrating can also be very privately sitting, drinking your coffee on a sunny morning, watching people go past in the street, and reading a book you may not finish. Yes, you have been blessed and baffled with success lately, and also, God, yes, there is the ferocity of having a new lover. But what about behaving as if none of these things were relevant to your own strict project? Sometimes accuracy must take the place of expansiveness, so leaving all these things not where you can see them, but all right where you can just about feel the light brown confidence of them, take yourself off into another room. They must not be useful even to cast your thoughts towards in moments of hesitation. Instead, the finger of the mind must be poised to run down a skirt of dusky pink satin, or over a white tablecloth embroidered in black work, or yes, must curve and thrill at the strong coffee drunk outside in the sun. Or picture a gorge worn in English limestone, grassy at the top and then rocky as it winds downhill, with moss and trees and water bubbling. This entirely meaningless place get you there and gaze. This is what is so difficult to learn, to stop talking, stop anticipating, stop being vigilant in your ancient, unnecessary way. The time as it passes, isn't it cool and exquisitely textured like linen? What else? Rather than announcing various refusals in the name of your own well-being, you would do better to find things to say yes to. Sometimes do make yourself tremble by agreeing to everything that is suggested. Tremble at everything you yourself have the potential to do. Then you can reinstall the proper curtains which divide the possible from the actually impossible, and perhaps choose a new pattern or style for them, or insert additional pleats where there were no pleats. Though all the same, remember, you are not designing a hotel. You will have to live here. Likewise, it is almost certain that neither aubergine roasted with harissa, nor a navy t-shirt bought for £3 from Oxfam, nor a book about the history of Baghdad will entirely solve the problem, because the problem exists elsewhere, as if in flowing water, while you are sitting on the bank. Dip a hand in would be one possibility, and feel how water is unattached to any of these bought and sold objects, how water wishes most of all to collapse into itself, yet depends on its own surface tension to resist this until the very end. Or you could notice how your lover's skin requires no accoutrements to be warm and lightly haired, or how the pleasure of their fingertips on your lower back loops and bunches and builds until the word pleasure ceases to make sense, like a bursting of the idea of pleasure, in fact, into smithereens. Afterwards, yes, you can sit up in bed and read Walt Whitman while they sleep. Then going into the office the next morning, you can take an unreligious but still fairly pious joy in the answering of emails and the making of phone calls, because there is a satisfaction here that can be trickled out like sand, and because you can feel how each of those other realms is kept steady and will wait for you to come back. Try taking on the buttoned-up calm of someone who has pledged their life to a service and forbidden themselves from ever doubting their choice. So what if? All that? One day you will find a cotton sundress that fits you beautifully. It cannot be doubted. In the meantime, you have a committee to circulate papers for, and you must adjudicate on your team's annual leave, and your boss is relying on you to keep at bay someone who has been trying to get a meeting for weeks. Indeed, there is a certain benefit in having a boss, someone you can serve without having to be grateful to them, which is a restful and low-risk experiment in true submission, and which also explains the ubiquitous narrative gesture consisting of the sudden command, "Turn around," the wordless lifting of the skirt, the being bent forwards over the varnished mahogany desk, and so on. The fantasy of comprehensiveness is the thing, that the remit of the boss could be infinitely enlarged across your whole life. Remember, though, that like most people, you would only wish to serve someone who wanted from you the things you already want from yourself. So, what would be the point? Whatever you may wishfully think, you do not need to be enforced to be effectual. Honestly, your power of forgetting all these things, or at least of living as if you didn't know them, is quite impressive. You are in the running to become a campus perpetual. The amount of time you luxuriously spend there, drinking tea with friends in the shade outside the cafe, modeling for others the long-form delight of having finished a PhD. The class of campus perpetuals is not a bad one to belong to. They like you there. They ought to. You've hung around now for years. But perhaps it is like drinking only the water vapor which rises from the earth, rather than water in the form of actual water. At least, if you can be persuaded of one thing, take to heart that summer is nearly over. There is a tide of knitwear and tea cakes making its way towards you, and you had better make sure you can still think and read and write in complete paragraphs, since that is, or at least ought to be, the cooling effect of autumn. On the other hand, your problem is that you often keep your present too sharply angled towards the future. One success and you are writhing with it, as if all is coming. Remember, for instance, that wearing mascara is always an invitation for the mascara to run. And indeed, stop trying to be the clear, cool voice of truth, however compassionate, like rain. Yes, we are finally having rain after a long drought. You have only one person's capacity for life, and things run over by the tongue always feel bigger than they really are. There are different schools of thought on whether it would be a waste of a day just to sit watching the rain. But whatever the conclusion, try to refrain from enthusing in anything other than the narrowest, most central part of yourself. And there, enthuse day and night. Ignore sleep. Enthusiasm is a project which cannot rest. Reverence the rain as something we have all needed, including you, and summer rain above all as the blessing no one is able to bestow on themselves or anyone else. And remember how you and your friend once sat under the awning of the cafe while it rained and rained and were treated with special friendliness by the staff, partly, let us assume, because it was raining and you were nonetheless choosing to sit there and buy things, but also seemingly because they liked you both. They enjoyed the air of playful discussion you gave off. The two of you drew people in with your obvious chemistry and affection, and from that alone you can deduce, which you know already, that such friendships are rarer, like whales. You could travel your whole ocean life and never encounter one. What do you want, now we come to it, is style that comes from a very full and considered embrace of everything except the idea of evil, which you must not credit. The world is wonderfully everything that is wonderfully the case, something like that. But a warning, the more you are like this, the younger people will think you are, because it is considered abnormal to plunge with an absolutely cheerful and fixated eye. The more you are like this, the better you will write and the worse you will dress. One thing you might experiment with further is lending out certain permissions of yourself. Did not your friend say a few months ago, fill some notebooks, and have you not been slowly putting this into practice and finding it gratifying? Your notebooks are filling with thoughts that sometimes are clean and sparkling, and other times burrowing and twisting like fox tunnels in the earth. So perhaps allow another friend to decide whether you should have a beer with lunch, or to press a book on you, which you will actually undertake to read, or to choose the color you will paint your bathroom. Allow your timetable to be gently pulled out of shape or wiped blank as a way of allowing yourself to be gently pulled out of shape or even wiped blank. Spend a day with your lover in which there are no plans. In fact, come to treat the idea of plans with deep suspicion, as if irreversibly corrupted. Not always, just sometimes. You need time to notice that the grass is a little greener again and the trees a little fuller after yesterday's rain. This is the second half of the joy of rain, which has its own unquestionable structure. A better structure indeed for deciding how to fill time. Fill time, what a notion, than the making of actual plans. What is this rule you've absorbed that you are not allowed to lie on your bed reading a book in the middle of the day? You cannot be serious. What else then? It seems you do at least understand that there is no point in trying to do too much, and the main thing now is making sure you don't do too little. The slack in the line should only be very slight, perceptible more to you than to anyone else. Or perhaps what you must convey is that if your time appears like a dress cut quite loosely with room to move, that is, it's deliberate cut. It's not that you have bought the wrong size. Or your time is a lawn, requiring nightly watering to produce its densest, luscious green, though of course you must be wary of any metaphor that depends on a monoculture. Or your time is a paragraph, which, whatever it does in the middle, must have its beginnings and ends placed quite carefully. So now returning to the question of how to celebrate, tend towards austerity. You adore the sitting praying, the obedient getting up early. You cannot forget the solemn hymn tune in its ancient minor mode. Last night you woke your lover up to cry. That is all right, but in the morning, you must quietly say goodbye to them and go to your desk. And there anything can be extended or pressed down on itself or pleasurably kneaded. Anything. Take your copy of one of the lesser-known plays, perhaps All's Well That Ends Well, and read it carefully with attention to each obscure phrase, solving one Shakespearean problem after another, or else go to the world, by which Shakespeare means get married. And armed with these techniques and precepts, you will be able to think, my God, every time I sit down to write, I might discover anything at all. Remember that your whole life is like a diary of life, indexed to various long novels you have read and various cups of coffee you have drunk with friends. Some of this must be kept. Be patient. There's never any rush. Soon it will be time once again for Henry James, and his paragraphs, each one like a new civilization. Autumn is coming, which is to say, all. Rosalind Brown grew up in Cambridge, England. She is the author of Practice, which was released in June by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Next, we'll delve into new books, reviewed by Dan Pippenbring. The AARP stands for nothing. In 1999, the group announced that its four-letter initialism, which for more than 40 years had denoted the American Association of Retired Persons, would thenceforth have no defined meaning. What once was a name became a vacuum. According to the AARP's website, this cavity reflects the full diversity of our membership, a significant percentage of which is not retired. It also reflects the organization's impossible desire to distance itself from itself. The first boomers were heading over the hill in 99, and for them, one newspaper columnist wrote, AARP might as well mean RIP. The name change catered to their denialism. No old people here, only older people approaching oldness asymptotically. You may not realize you're looking at an older person until there's a younger person beside him, and both of them might belong to the AARP, which welcomes everyone 18 and over. It's an interest group that has achieved a state of ascetic disinterest. Still, the AARP has flourished, while other old-age advocacy groups have withered on the vine. Nary a mailbox in this country has not bulged with its onslaught of membership cards, brochures, insurance policy notices, and above all, with AARP the magazine, whose readership is roughly 65 times that of this magazine. For decades, we've been living in AARP Nation, as James Chappelle calls it in Golden Years, How Americans Invented and Reinvented Old Age, Basic Books, $32. This is a place where a 50-year-old and a 90-year-old are both expected to be vital and optimistic, in search of an elusive dignity that derives from access to good weather, reasonable prices, and pharmaceutical interventions for erectile dysfunction. Here, older Americans clamor not for better public health care or a universal basic income, but for private sector solutions to the problems of senior living, Chappelle writes. Chief among those problems has been the perception of seniority itself. The AARP emphasizes lifestyle over public policy. Its message, as Chappelle hears it, is anything young people can do, you can do too, ideally by using AARP services. The heart of AARP Nation is, of course, Florida. Burnished by the senior citizens of yesteryear into a gleaming mecca of early bird dinners and palm-fringed shuffleboard courts, it is today a hub for pickleball and hard Mountain Dew, definitely over 21 launch parties. A 1972 article published by the AARP opined that had Ponce de Leon remained in Florida, he would have abandoned his quest for the Fountain of Youth, preferring retirement and its sunny clime to eternal youth elsewhere. The conversation around aging used to be more heterodox and more demanding. To juice the economy during the Depression, a doctor named Francis Townsend proposed a payment of $200 a month, roughly $5,000 in 2024 dollars, to every American over 60 on the condition that they spend all of it within 30 days. The Townsend plan launched a thorny debate over the purpose of old age in an industrial society. His slogan was youth for work, age for leisure. Across the country, 2 million people joined Townsend clubs, agitating for the passage of the plan in Congress. The press followed around a sexagenarian man and wife as they proved that parting with $200 was easy. Had he lived to see the first great retirement communities in the 60s, Townsend might have smiled to learn that one of them was called Leisure World. Behind its rotating 30-foot globe, retirees rode oversized tricycles and took up woodworking or the kazoo. Leisure World seems to have been a genuinely fun and inviting place to live, Chappelle writes, his shock wafting from the page. But only the rich could afford to live there. Townsendites had found some succor in the Social Security Act, but most felt that it didn't go nearly far enough. This is not a view we've heard lately. In Chappelle's telling, Social Security and Medicare are the bedrock of the American concept of old age, and yet few old age advocacy groups do much to acknowledge or bolster them. Even The Golden Girls, a liberal sitcom, especially by the standards of the Reagan years, hardly mentioned the programs in its many episodes on financial precarity. Make no mistake, the girls were getting a little help from Uncle Sam. The elderly no longer know how to refer to themselves. Older Americans may summon a wide horizon and a plump sunset, but it's terminally inclusive. For decades, Chappelle writes, the central idea had been that the aged or senior citizens were a distinct identity group with distinct needs, and that those needs should be met by the state. Today, No one can meet the needs of older people because no one knows who they are. The closest thing we have to towns and clubs now are boomers and Mustangs blasting Pete Townsend, hoping they die before they get old, not accepting that this means that they would already be dead. It's easy to resent them for this, especially as they continue to hoard their wealth. You look for the tan lines they get from keeping their heads in the sand. But I feel for them. Should I get the chance to age, I have no confidence I'll do it gracefully. Chappelle delves into statistics and academic conferences more than he does the psychology of old age, which he can't quite bring to life. Here's what you'd call a big picture guy, writing about a subject whose pathos is all in the close-ups. Even so, there's a profound loneliness skulking around his book. This story is not a tragedy, he writes, and yet it always ends in death. His more leaden sections finally land on grim reality, as in this one about a study of nursing homes from the early 70s. A full 39% of the time, residents were doing nothing at all, what the investigators called null activity, and which included sleeping, sitting alone, or staring into space. Another 17% of the time was classified as passive activity, as when smoking or rocking in a chair. Thus, they concluded, 56% of the residents' time during the day, from morning to evening, was spent doing nothing. Much of the rest was spent watching television. I've just understood why the AARP hollowed out its name. Null activity is fiction's raison, the seething, ruminant life of the mind. You might call it staring into space. I call it The Loser by Thomas Bernhard. I wouldn't have pegged Ulve Jansson, a Finnish writer best known for children's books about a race of rotund, huggable trolls called Moomins, as a master of null activity, but she was. Visiting Florida in 1972, Jansson was amused and alarmed by St. Petersburg, a city dominated by sunny silence. The piece was almost sinister, she wrote. Everything has been prepared for rest and old age, inexorable and ideal. The stereotypes of retirement had not yet ossified. AARP Nation was a new territory, undiscovered if not fertile, and Jansson explored it in Sun City, New York Review Books, 1695, now reissued in Thomas Teal's 1976 translation. The novel ensconces us on the veranda of St. Petersburg's Berkeley Arms, a well-kept retirement home where the days pass in breezy, saturnine, sometimes bracing idleness. Here there's time enough to get some thinking done about rocking chairs, how it took a certain amount of attention to keep a rocking chair from rocking, and what a feat it would be to place rocking chairs in groups, that is, rocking toward each other. It would take a great deal of space, and in the long run, it might be tiresome. Of course, the original, the natural idea, was a single rocking chair in motion in an otherwise static room. There's not much to do in Sun City. A novel about null activity doesn't go in for a plot. Jansson just gathers her oldsters and makes a spectacle of their segregation. What a clever idea to get us all together in the same place, where we can enjoy ourselves without being in the way, says one character sincerely. They grouse and gripe their way toward the spring ball with its cavalcade of hats, at which the mayor dies mid-dance. A closeted old vaudeville star, the exquisitely named Tim Tillerton, comes to town, both to outrun and relive his glory days. There's a sudden appearance of an irascible ex-wife, a trip through Silver Spring State Park on a glass-bottomed boat, and a misadventure in the forest, the deaths of the Bahalga sisters, who were so quiet that no one knew their first names, and cigarettes by the carton. This is back when seniors still lit up. It can be hard to tell Jansson's characters apart. They all mourn and nurse their private grievances. The blur may be intentional. The sun seems to dry the distinctions out of them, and they know it. The women outnumber the men who have, of course, died, leaving a fraught mass of Hannah Higginses, Elizabeth Morrises, Evelyn Peabodys, Catherine Freys. Their bickering is amusing, particularly with Jansson's arch timing. but it's when they're quiet that the novel soars. Frey, wandering the hot streets on a quest to get her hair done, sees old ladies by the hundreds in salon chairs. So much old hair being washed and set, dyed, sprayed, and backcombed. So much white and gray down being brushed up against balding heads. Soon she is one of them, sunken under plastic shrouds deep into a world of damp terry cloth and the humming greenhouse warmth of dryers, a world promising forgetfulness for several peaceful hours. Everything in the crowded room was pink, even the telephone. It was a closed feminine sanctuary where Miss Frey fell asleep, massaged at last with Silver Spray number 5. The Brickley Arms overlooks a placid harbor, the home of a replica of the HMS Bounty, a tourist attraction on which wax models of sailors reenact their famous mutiny. Visitors receive plastic hibiscus blooms. The mutineers have been tamed. Whatever gave rise to their unrest is just a memory. There are only two young people in this novel, swept up in a passionate, naive romance. One of them is convinced that Jesus will return any day now, to the beach, probably in Miami. If they only knew, he thinks about the old, if they only realized that time had run out and their whole ruined world didn't matter anymore. Someone could have gotten this message to Joe Biden before the primaries and saved us all a lot of grief. I thought of Biden a lot while reading Sun City, and also of Dick Van Dyke, who, now 98, has been old, still handsome though, for the entire time I've been alive, and who has taken to introducing himself at public appearances by saying, "I'm what's left of Dick Van Dyke." This book's original dust jacket called it an indictment of the American way of old age, which is too strong an assertion for such a wistful tale, though it has notes of well-deserved condescension. Probably only a Scandinavian could have written it. Jonsson knew she'd be retiring to the ample bosom of the Finnish welfare state, not hacking it out with clip coupons and wraparound sunglasses. The St. Petersburg press was not kind to her. One critic complained that Sun City would have you think that the city's whole population was elderly, when in fact only 27.3% were 65 or older. Another critic faulted her for having carelessly misnamed the familiar Senior Citizens Club near the pier as the Senior Club. The critic made no comment about the sign that Jonsson hung in her senior club. Members dance at their own risk. Was that really there? I believe it was. The next piece I'll be reading is Dying is a Form of Education on Elden Ring by Gabriel Winslow Yost. Discussed in this essay, Elden Ring, developed by From Software, Bandai Namco, $59.99. Elden Ring, Shadow of the Erdtree, developed by From Software, Bandai Namco, $39.99. Video games, even when played alone, have to be understood communally. Not just understood differently, as with other art forms, but literally different. Different things happen in them, big or small, as each player plays it in their own way, makes their own choices, provokes different outcomes. So the only way you can really come to know a game is by finding out how it went for other people and by telling other people how it went for you. From every game that is dropped into the world, such accounts ripple outward. Anecdotes, analyses, debates, and rumors, these days mostly online, in the form of wikis, Twitch streams, YouTube videos, and Reddit posts. No games have demonstrated this more clearly or more extravagantly than the recent works by the Japanese studio From Software, Demon's Souls, the Dark Souls series, Bloodborne, Sekiro, and most recently, Elden Ring. They are complex, idiosyncratic action games, at once dour and ridiculous, maddening and mesmerizing. Playing, you might find yourself guiding your sword-wielding warrior into battle against a giant dragon who throws lightning bolts at you, while the soundtrack swells. Or you might send him creeping through a dark sewer, only to fall into a pit filled with giant googly-eyed lizards, choke on the black gas they emit, and lose an hour of progress. Each of these games has been accompanied by a frenzy of commentary and reaction. There are endless, sometimes vicious arguments over which of the games, levels, bosses, weapons are best or worst, over how their influence has changed the rest of the industry, or how it should. Thousands of videos document moments of surprise, people reacting to a boss discarding his robes to reveal his true identity, to a wall dissolving at a touch. Moments of triumph, someone beating the game without dodging, or someone using bongos as a controller, or brainwaves, or Morse code. Someone simply beating a boss at last, however they can. Someone, somehow, beating all the games back to back without ever being hit. Moments, above all, of failure, a relentless series of slapstick shorts in which the punchline is always you died, crushed by a trap, lured off the edge of a cliff, incinerated by a dragon, slashed by some baffling blade-wielding monstrosity, beaten up in a corner by a couple of raggedy soldiers. One might find failure more particular and sustained. After spending a few dozen hours trying to beat the final boss of Shadow of the Erdtree, the recent expansion of Elden King, Kai Cenat, a Twitch streamer so popular he accidentally caused a riot in Manhattan last year, consulted with a therapist about his waning confidence as the camera rolled. You are listening to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Where matters might turn academic. Emotive, hours-long retellings of the game's stories, analyses of their architecture, symbolism, and art historical inspirations, accounts of how playing them helps someone deal with depression or understand what it is to battle grief. These are video games in the gamiest sense, violent, repetitive, grandiose, silly. In fact, they are probably the most influential video games of the past decade, inspiring a new subgenre of Souls-likes and changing how designers approach storytelling, level design, combat, and failure in all sorts of ways. But at times they can seem, for their tens of millions of players, more like a strange kind of interactive scripture to be pondered, parsed, defended, and used to understand the world. They certainly didn't start that way. The first, Demon's Souls, 2009, was developed with little oversight by a team led by a young designer named Taka Miyazaki. Miyazaki knew his ideas for Demon's Souls would seem unsaleable, so he hid them from his superiors until it was too late to change the design. The game was released without much fanfare and exclusively in Japan. It was exported to the West only after a few enterprising critics and fans got their hands on the game and raved about it. It sold slowly, then less slowly. The Dark Souls trilogy, 2011 through 16, followed along with Bloodborne, 2015, and Sekiro, 2019, and by now the Soulsborne games, as fans refer to them collectively, have sold well over 80 million copies. The newest and most ambitious, Elden Ring, was the second best-selling game of 2022, which, if it were a movie, would make it Top Gun Maverick. They are all, in a general sense, conventional action games. You control your character from a close third-person perspective and spend most of your time fighting. Most of the games are set in a horror-tinged version of Western high fantasy. There are knights and dragons, giants and monsters, swords and spells, and the occasional club made from an enormous magical severed finger. Bloodborne turns instead to Victorian horror, Sekiro to a fantastical 16th century Japan. As you fight, you acquire new weapons, increase your character's abilities, and find more and bigger monsters to fight until you reach one last enemy, kill him or it, and the credits roll, the usual. The closer you look, though, the stranger the games get. Where most action games want you to hurtle through them, all speed and momentum and ever-changing spectacle, the Soulsborne games are ponderous and frustrating. Your character moves slowly, and even minor enemies can kill you within seconds. You creep along. Progress comes in dribs and drabs, earned through painful repetition. Where most video games try to seem vibrant and alive, hiding their simulated nature beneath as much movement and variation as they can, these make no effort to conceal the fact that the worlds they present are pre-programmed and artificial. Enemies, though visually elaborate, move in clear, repeated patterns, and they often stand perfectly still when left alone. It is not an imitation of the complexity of real life, but an intricate, hostile mechanism that creaks into action as the player approaches. Many of the features of this mechanism, basic facts about how the game works, are kept deliberately obscure. The player is left to stumble about, guessing at things that any normal game would explain immediately. Why is my health cut in half after I die, but only sometimes? Why is there a number tracking my humanity or insight, and what does it do? And what, for that matter, is my humanity? Why does my character just sort of flop to the ground when I try to roll? Large areas of the games, including several of the best in both Dark Souls and Elden Ring, are tucked away in hidden corners, and the games can be completed without your ever even realizing they exist. With the exception of Sekiro, the games are also a peculiar mix of single-player and multiplayer. Though you generally play by yourself, the games of other players bleed into yours if you are connected to the internet. Their translucent ghosts flicker into sight. Bloodstains show where they have died and function as warnings or comic relief. You might watch a ghost blithely run through the door to the next area, then come tumbling back through to die in a panicked heap at your feet. Messages left by other players appear in your world, offering hints, encouragement, jokes, or bald-faced lies. There are also systems, intentionally a bit cumbersome, for entering other players' games to help or attack them, and for inviting them to enter yours. Much has been made of the difficulty of these games. It has been criticized as exclusionary, lauded as a return to gaming's roots, used as a selling point. "Prepare to die," declared the slogan of the first Dark Souls. But difficulty is an elusive concept, one word standing in for a number of ways in which a game can resist its players. The Soulsborne games are obtuse and unforgiving, cruelly willing to discard your progress and waste your time. Each encounter is an invitation to panic and blunder and be forced to repeat it. Especially in the earlier games, saving was heavily restricted and progress could be easily lost. One brain-dead stumble can set you back an hour. But the bar to progress is not, in the end, so very high. Soulsborne games do not require great dexterity or reflexes, or the processing of large amounts of complex information, as some games do. They are a test, instead, of patience and understanding, of will, not skill. Another way to put it is that the games can be, for the wrong person, or someone in the wrong mood, simply unpleasant. It is not always clear why one would want to spend one's leisure time swearing at a screen, lost, stuck, dying over and over in the dark. More often, though, they provide something much more complicated, a paradoxical mix of joy and outrage, relief and despair. The repetitive drumbeat of failure, occasionally punctuated by success or disaster or revelation, batters you into a kind of gleeful serenity. Failure becomes funny, even soothing. The games are full of jokes at the player's expense, traps and dead ends, and carefully orchestrated aggravations. Game after game runs variations on the comedic setup of an enormous stone ball rolling at you down a slope, for instance. It's there in the opening level of Dark Souls, to teach you about dodging, about the game designer's malevolence. Then it appears again and again in more complicated arrangements. By Elden Ring, such traps have become familiar, even comforting, until the moment when a boulder rolls past you, stops, and then rolls back, seemingly of its own free will, to crush you from behind. The only possible response is to laugh or give up. Miyazaki has said that part of the original idea for Demon's Souls was to get back to basics, to make a game the way games used to be. His is a selective, even perverse memory of those olden times, with the gaps and limitations of earlier games turned into deliberate features, their accidents and oddities now ingrown, alien. Before there was so much information about them available online, video games often accumulated rumors of secrets hidden at the edges of the map, mysterious features slipped into the code. From Software deliberately cultivates those mysteries, demanding that players sort through rumors as they play. Back when games were still played mostly in arcades, they were usually based around a staccato interplay of repetition and progression. The faster a player failed, the sooner they could be lured into putting in more money. The Soulsborne games slow this rhythm down to a lingering, luxurious examination of failure for its own sake. They do not return to a previous simplicity, but take a route through the old to the new. Often this involves teasing out the emotional possibilities of game design contrivances. For instance, in all these games, your character is notably smaller than the enemies you fight. Even other humans generally tower over you. Part of this is simply convenience. Since the games are played in third person, a smaller player character makes it easier to see past them to the rest of the world, and larger enemies are less likely to be obscured in close quarters combat. But it also means that the world itself feels more threatening and alien, the player more fragile, triumphs more tenuous and unlikely. The architecture often reflects this, with doors and stairways clearly made for much more massive beings than you. Even more unusual is the game's approach to storytelling, or rather, the near absence of traditional storytelling. Though they have elaborate fictional worlds and complex plots, little of either is communicated directly. Instead, much of the narrative is concealed, and large parts are erased entirely. The player is tossed a few proper nouns and vague declarations. In Dark Souls, players are told that they are the chosen undead in the cursed land of Lordran, and must ring the bell of awakening. In Elden Ring, that they are a tarnished who has returned to the lands between to try to mend the Elden Ring after the Shattering, and dumped into the game. The traditional means of video game storytelling, cutscenes, voiceover narration, and conversations with other characters, are present only in the most attenuated, enigmatic forms. The significance of what you're told, and all the other details of the setting and story, and your role in it, are scattered in a vast heap of hints and fragments. In the brief textual descriptions attached to weapons and items, in the few sparse interactions with other characters, in the visual details of landscapes, buildings, and enemies. These are all easy to miss if you aren't paying attention. You could make it to the end of the game without any real idea of what is going on, let alone ever quite figuring out what a tarnished might be. Even if you are paying attention, it isn't easy to piece it all together. Elden Ring's story, especially, is complicated and ambiguous. The Lands Between is a dense, deranged rendition of a traditional fantasy continent, its very name like a garbled machine translation of Middle Earth. Rolling grasslands, misty forests, enchanted lakes, snowy mountains, deserts, castles, a magical school, even a volcano, all mashed together and filled with monsters. From shards of narration and other clues, one can learn that it has been ruled, formed, deformed, and fought over by a series of gods, demigods, and the even more powerful abstract forces that choose and empower them. The greater will holds sway, as shown by the enormous glowing Ur-tree that looms over the world and various outer gods lurk. Everyone you encounter is aligned in some way or other with one of them. This history swarms with vexingly similar names. Radagon, Radon, Rikard, Renla, Rilana, Renna, Rani, Rodrika, and Rajie. Godfrey, Gowrie, Godric, Godwin, and Gronk. Marquis, Margot, Moog, Marika, Muriel, Millennia, Millicent, Michaela, and Malaketh, many of whom are related to one another, only some of whom are human, depending on your definition, and some of whom turn out to be the same being under different names. You meet and kill most of them by the end of the game. Piecing together an actual narrative around those names is not easy. You might wonder, for instance, about Marika, that she is the reigning deity of the lands between. It's fairly clear from the ubiquitous statues of her likeness strewn across the landscape and various scraps of narration. But other seemingly basic facts, how she is related to the other demigods, how she came to power, why she apparently set off the shattering, apocalyptic event that left the entire continent in chaos and a state of civil war, emerge only in stray lines of dialogue or a few seconds of gnomic cutscene, or are never answered at all. It's not a narrative you simply experience. You either ignore most of it, or you go a little insane, poring over minute details and message board speculation like a conspiracy theorist. Do eye colors have a deeper significance? Yes, of course. What's up with all the giant fingers? An essay in itself. And what could it possibly mean that Marika, spoiler alert, is the same person as Radagon, her second husband, especially since they seem to have been on opposite sides of the shattering? That baffling answer is revealed only if you use a specific spell in front of a specific statue or through an otherwise extremely confusing cutscene near the end of the game, and itself requires further explanation that is never provided. Everything comes that way, implicit, incomplete, out of order, deliberately unclear. Miyazaki has said that his approach to narrative was inspired by his childhood experiences reading Western fantasy novels, which he could understand only partially. For Elden Ring, he actually hired one of his favorite fantasy authors, George R.R. Martin, to help write the underlying mythology, which was then duly obscured. It does have that feel, a few names and spots of clarity shining through a mist of uncertainty. But if anything, this understates how puzzling and enigmatic even fundamental events and concepts are in his game's stories. It is impossible, really, for any individual player to piece everything together on their own in a normal playthrough, and some major questions are left completely unanswered. To unlock these mysteries, a large, energetic online community has devoted itself to combing through the games and compiling discoveries, theories, and counter-theories. Controversies can hinge on the exact meaning of a single phrase, on possible mistranslations from the Japanese original. Was the great tree meant to be distinct from the Ur tree or not? On subtle details of costume and statuary. Unused material dug up in the code serves the role of apocrypha, illuminating, say, the possible significance of the god of frenzied flame through a storyline that was cut from the game before its release. A few of these explicators even make a living doing it. The most prominent, an Australian named Michael Samuels, who posts under the name Vativitya, has pursued it as a full-time job since 2015. YouTube videos on subjects like the lore of Elden Ring's dragons and Elden Ring's demigods explained are slickly produced, often over an hour long, and viewed by millions. Consulting such sources is the only way to get a solid grasp on the story. The shared exegesis, though external to the game itself, is integral to the experience of playing it. Marco Caracciolo, a professor of English and literary theory at Ghent University in Belgium, recently published a brief academic monograph about this odd way of telling a story under the slightly cumbersome title On Souls Ring Worlds, Narrative Complexity, Digital Communities, and Interpretation in Dark Souls and Elden Ring. These games engage in a form of environmental storytelling, he writes, that creates an archaeological mode of fandom, which denotes attention to environmental clues and an emotional investment in the material history of the game world. And these online debates can often feel like a warped, counterfactual form of academia. One popular YouTube exegete, in fact, posed as the tarnished archaeologist. Caracciolo also evokes Umberto Eco's influential understanding of the open work as an experimental text that is co-constructed by the audience, which certainly seems apt. But Eco's examples, the music of Stockhausen and Boulez, the writings of Mallarmé and Joyce, point to a crucial difference. The work of those artists is often forbidding and abstruse, and for all their influence and longevity, none was ever accused of being a bestseller. Elden Ring and its predecessors are extremely popular despite their narrative withholding. The experience of playing them is immediate, not esoteric, and people seek them out by the millions. Somehow, the absence of a clear story never makes the game itself feel muddled or meaningless. This is because video games don't actually need stories in any normal sense. No matter what a game does or does not tell you, the primary experience is always your own progress through it, your mistakes, your discoveries, your victories. Everything else, all the plot twists, backstories, and characterization a game might contain, is layered on top of that base. Mainstream, big-budget games tend to slather it on thick, with plenty of heroism and pathos, but many other games have no explicit narrative at all, Tetris, Bejeweled, or one so thin and derivative as to be essentially vestigial. Classics like Doom and Mario Brothers have stories that might as well have been written on a napkin. The Soulsborne games never obscure that fundamental moment-by-moment experience. It is clear and sharp, an intense, carefully controlled story of exploration, intimidation, and struggle. Every detail of the landscape is made significant for what it might offer or threaten or allow. Paths curling back on themselves, unexpected glimpses of distant areas, items placed just out of reach, enemies lurking in a perfectly inconvenient spot. A precise interweaving of curiosity, anxiety, frustration, exhilaration, and relief. The architects Lou Casper Pearson and Sandra Yukana devote an early chapter of their lovely, astute Video Game Atlas 2022 to Dark Souls, noting the way its landscapes derive from both 18th century Western principles of the picturesque, the prized scenic views, unconventional pathways, and architectural motifs such as ruins that communicate a symbolism of deep time and mythology, and an even older Japanese focus on the power of ruination. Much of it is spectacular, but nothing is ever pristine. As you play, you move through crumbling shrines, drowned cities, abandoned palaces, rotting sewers, fields of ash. It couldn't be clearer, no matter how murky the story gets, that this is a world long since fallen and from a great height. Its derelict grandeur is also in a certain amount of tension with the constraints on the player, which are many. The game suggests immensity rather than actually providing it, confining your movements to a limited array of predefined paths between generally small locations. Elden Ring, on the other hand, is the first of From Software's games to be centered on a non-linear open world. Here, the biggest surprises often come from the reverse. How much can be accessed? The surface of landscape open to the player is enormous compared with the previous games. Dark Souls might take you a few dozen hours to complete. Elden Ring, well over 100. The shock is not the expanse alone, but the density, the way every hillock and cavern is filled with incident and variety. Much of the drama of the player's progress through the landscape is provided by the periodic revelation of new vistas, a lowland of misty lakes and waterlogged ruins stretching out beneath you as you reach the edge of a cliff, a narrow, unassuming hallway that suddenly opens out above a vast, maze-like royal city, all of which you can, in fact, explore. Perhaps the most celebrated moment in the game involves neither combat nor narrative, but one of these sudden disclosures of space. A seemingly modest stone building tucked away in a forest turns out to be an elevator that descends lingeringly, unexpectedly, inexplicably, into an underground realm so huge that its distant ceiling sparkles with stars. In any other medium, Elden Ring's shadowy, archaeological, anti-epic would be alienating and experimental. If told conventionally, its remix of fantasy tropes might seem jumbled. But as a video game, it works, in many ways feeling more cohesive and natural than the rigid cinematic storytelling so many other games pursue. One of the insights underpinning From Software's games is a recognition of the opportunity that the medium presents, an opportunity not for narrative simplicity, as it has been seen in the past, but for a new kind of complexity, a centerless, centrifugal form of storytelling, defined by discontinuity and uncertainty, and yet, at the same time, propulsion and accessibility. This dispersed form also means that the game's most powerful effects come not from explicit statement or from any turn or climax in the story, but from a slow accretion of mood and symbolism. Action games, especially difficult ones, provide an emotional experience somewhere between aesthetics and exercise. They teach you things about yourself, about the limits and possibilities of your reflexes, dexterity, memory, and pattern recognition, about how you respond to your own failures. The texture of this experience varies from game to game. The relatively long, slow animations of the Soulsborne games, especially the early ones, and the inability to cancel an action once you've started it, mean that their fights are punctuated by tiny bursts of regret. You watch helplessly as an attack fails, or an attempt at evasion delivers you to doom. You can feel yourself oscillating between playing the game and observing it, rooting for your own success or bemoaning your incompetence. This experience lies outside, or perhaps beneath, the other aesthetic aspects of the game. You don't care how beautiful a castle is or what it's called when you are trying not to die on the ramparts. But the intense, intimate engagement it involves also heightens everything else. Each flickering detail of the world feels significant because, in this immediate sense, it is. We've run out of time, so please join me next week for the conclusion of Dying is a Form of Education on Elden Ring by Gabriel Winslow Yost. Thanks so much for joining me today for readings from the November 2024 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now.